someone said that to me about the music. They're like, wow, you take writing joyful music very seriously. You know, I think they were disappointed that it's not something that you just chuck out in 5 minutes.
Is having fun a part of the creative process that is too often overlooked? As part of my job, I get to know the artists here pretty well. And composer Anna Meredith is a joy to be around. Her music straddles both the classical and the electronic, crafting these big bills that she often sketches out beforehand. Artworks in their own right, I'd say. She's extremely driven and hardworking. The fairy lights in her studio are always on. In the past, she's made bespoke compositions for things like the machines that smooth down the ice rink. But this time round, she had an even more unusual idea to run past our boss. Welcome back to The Process, where we follow artists as they explore one idea that has emerged from a work in progress to see where it ends up. Episode 4, Taking Fun Seriously.
As a kid, you know, in my little town outside Edinburgh, once a year, the fair would come, which we would call the shows, for reasons I never totally understood, but, you know, the shows are coming. When you went down there, it was adult and scary, and there was, like, creepy-looking people with fags hanging out their mouths, you know, standing, looking threatening by the waltzers, and early 90s, you know, loud techno playing. Some of those sounds seep into a lot of my writing. I think probably because they came in these really important times for me growing up. I'm Anna Meredith. I'm a composer and producer. I love being overwhelmed by things, and where I love things that mean that I can't think. You know, as someone with, you know, quite a lot of anxiety, I love something that takes me out of myself and allows me just to be in the moment of what I'm doing. I definitely find it easier when it's something really physical. I remember Jonathan Riecke, Somerset House's chief exec, came in at the start of the pandemic, and I was asking what was going to happen with the ice rink that they normally have. Social distancing was starting to become a thing at that point, and I had this like crystal clear, like, I know what you should do. I think you should put Dodgems in there. And amazingly, he just was like, that's a great idea, and it's kind of grown from there to become a Dodge. Immediately the wheels were turning, and I was thinking, I want to make them into a musical thing.
Drivers, bumps per minute is about to begin. We'll be cruising clockwise, so keep your limbs and loved ones under control at all times.
The obvious connection to music is the bump of the Dodgems and how to use that in the music.
So, buckle up. Start your engines. Get ready to rumble. Get ready to trundle. We drive in 3, in 2, in 1.
A tune, basically, for each of the 18 Dodgems that get triggered one at a time when people bump their cars. You know, whatever the new one is. I'm not an amazing musical collaborator. I think I figured that out a while ago. And I'm not great. I'm not an improviser, or, you know, there's not much space. There's not much freedom in my music. So what's nice about this, I guess, is I am giving a lot of control over to drivers in terms of I don't know what tunes are going to be played. And it's freed me to write stuff that I wouldn't normally maybe have the guts to do. Yeah, someone said that to me about the music. They're like, wow, you take writing joyful music very seriously. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's, you know, I think they were disappointed that it's not something that you just, you know, chuck out in 5 minutes. So obviously with Bumps Per Minute, you can't predict which car is going to bump when and therefore which piece of music is going to play. So I guess it then poses some big questions about the role of the composer. It's still me that's written the music, but if I'm not in charge of the order of the music or the time-based experience, the thing that normally matters to me most, does that mean the drivers are composers too? I've been working with Nick Ryan, who is amazing sound artist, a few doors down from me here in the studios.
I often think with interactivity, it's not a case of the composer giving up control as much as it is them choosing to give the listener a good time or not.
He's an amazing sound designer. He works on music for film, but he's also very interested in elements of control. He makes a lot of physical instruments that are controlled by things like weather or space junk. So this idea of control and interaction is a really a central aspect to his work.
The more control you give a listener or a driver, the less of a good time they have, I think.
Oh, why is that?
Because I think ultimately, as a listener, you want to be told a story. Mm-hmm. And the more agency you give the audience, the less authorship there is for a story, an external storyteller. Mm-hmm. And you end up, ultimately, you know, is that the audience member has a bunch of tools they don't know how to use, mm-hmm. and they don't tell themselves a story.
Mm-hmm. So how does authorship and interaction, you know, how much of a part of your kind of general music practice is it?
It's very important because I think an unavoidable consequence of listening is that there is always interactivity. Because you cannot predict how someone will hear sound in their mind. You're inviting a listener, when you play them a piece of music, to co-author it with you. And that's what makes music so powerful for individual listeners.
Right, people could just be thinking about food.
Yeah, or they
for example.
I mean, a good example of this, for me, I saw someone on the bus a few years ago listening to a song on their smartphone. Mm. Out of a mono speaker in one ear.
Right.
And they were having a great time. But this person could hear this piece of music, I guessed, as Fidelic, even though it was incredibly...
Right.
Incredibly low resolution.
Because they were making the leap to the real version of it.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
In their mind. Mm-hmm. So that's how powerful that kind of authorship is in the mind.
And is that something you're actively thinking about when you're, you know, if someone asks you to do something? It feels absolutely enormous to me and quite scary in the scope of what you could be considering in terms of levels of control and authorship. How do you, is it something you try and make sure is a factor in every composition?
Some of the sounds that I'm interested in as a sound designer are sounds which affect people physically. So they're not cultural, they're not emotional, they are physical. Like a good example is an explosion. You know, it will make someone feel instantaneously reactive to the sound. Mm-hmm. And those kind of sounds are things that you are experienced unquestioningly by the audience, and there is no gap. There's no interpretation. It's just sensation.
Mm.
It seems to me that your music is very much not just about the audience moving, it's about you moving as performers and using the body as an instrument.
Yeah, that's a really, yeah, I think you're right. I think I use my own body as a test when I'm writing. I am checking in with how stuff is making me feel. And quite often before, while I'm writing something, I won't even notice it, but I'm out of my chair and like hopping around my room, sort of punching the air and shouting, "Yes, Meredith," to myself, like some kind of psychopath. And so, yeah, I'm checking if stuff makes me have a physical reaction. Where do you think, you know, obviously there's so many more possibilities with interaction and authorship and technology. Do you think that's a direction music in general is heading?
I mean, music and technology have always, well, for the last 140 years, have been linked together in this really important relationship. And prior to that, you know, musical technology, instruments. And so, you know, interactive technology is no different in a way to that. But I think it's beginning to, you know, really change the form of music and the way that we use music and what we use music for, I think, is where the future lies. And I think if you kind of apply interaction to that, then you can, it's not difficult to imagine how music could be adaptive to our context, whether it's, you know, our time of day or our mood. And it's not that the composer is eliminated. This is not about kind of AI generative music. It's about music which is composed, but it's also adaptive and flexible. You know, thinking of new ways to make music elastic.
That's good.
What do you think about that? Do you hate the idea of music being adaptive?
I think I'm a bit scared by it, because I'm such a control freak and I know how to do what I know how to do, but I don't know how to do other things. I'm excited about how I could be part of those collaborations, but if every compositional of my personal compositional role was taken away, I think, you know, it probably wouldn't be for me.
But I think your live life is kind of similar in a way, because when you're performing it live, it feels like it's adapting.
I mean, it is in a very... I mean, I'm quite a horror. They're quite tightly controlled. I run a very tight ship, Nick.
Do you?
Yeah, there's none of this, like, should we do another verse? You know, absolutely not. You know, when I hear people saying, oh, I'll come and jam with you guys, like, are you kidding? No, you won't. I need to have control over what I'm doing. Otherwise, you know, I've just figured out what I can do. And when there's an idea that involves other people, like Dodge is brilliantly done, then that's so great, because otherwise I'm just in my bunker writing crotchets. Interesting hearing Nick talk about where he thinks music is headed and how it could become unstuck and away from the format and become more adaptive and reactive. What's interesting to me, though, is how so much of this sort of way of thinking really makes me think about games and game design, because games are something that I absolutely love. I love board games, I love escape rooms, I love video games, and to me they just, they completely absorb me. And if there's one of the things that I've realised over the process of making Bumps Per Minute is just how kind of meticulous you need to be when designing something that then eventually feels basically effortless and fun.
The thing about escape rooms, which is unique and magical, is that it's intimate. It's just you and the people that you love, hopefully, being told a story that you can solve and you can overcome and you can digest within an hour.
I came across the game designer Nick Moran. Yes, that's right, another Nick, because he's made all these games that I absolutely love. He made Time Run and The Lance of Longness and Sherlock. And I'm a big, you know, big fan, and I really wanted to know how he approaches writing the stories that govern these games and how much control you really have as a player. Nick, what is an escape room if you haven't done one before?
So escape rooms, a few years ago, I'd have said escape rooms, you enter a room, there's lots of puzzles, and the aim is to get out of the room. That's where it started. But now, of course, as the genre develops, now they're basically immersive game experiences. So it's that kind of meld between puzzle and storytelling and escapism in a live environment.
So I'm a real control freak with my writing. And so with doing the bumps per minute piece where the dodgems, you know, triggered the music, it was a real challenge trying to work out what level of control to hand over. There was obviously more I could give to the drivers. They could influence every aspect of the music, but I still wanted the music in itself to be good, or me at least. How do you get that balance of doing, you know, a good artistic project, a project that you can stand by, but giving enough control and autonomy to a user?
I think for me, when we're designing the game, I say, what do I need to ensure for my own sanity and my own satisfaction that people leave with? Mm. And I have to make sure that there are key things that they've understood and they've got. And everything else is a bonus, because right. they may not choose to do that. They may fight the structure and not consume that piece of content. They may try and bypass something, all this kind of stuff. Mm. The problem with an escape room is that ultimately it's a very structured experience, and it should be. It is ultimately linear underneath, and you're trying to tell a story. But because you can't be certain that people have any attention, or they're consuming it, or they're consuming in the right order, or they're even focused, you can't be certain that they are getting the right things. It is that question of, what am I willing to settle for that they understand? Mm-hmm. And for me, that's always the most difficult part.
Now, am I right that you might have made me a game?
I have made you a something, but yes, it is a game. Yes,
all right,
it is.
Tell me a little about what is it?
I would say that it's a choose your own adventure game.
Oh, classic, like the paper, you know, where you have to keep your fingers in the spaces in the old books.
Yeah, I used to have so many of these puzzle and choose your own adventure books when I was home. But I've created you one.
Oh.
It's a bit silly. So
please leave.
So I hope that's okay.
No, that's ideal. Well, I'm very excited. Should we do it?
Yeah, let's go. Anna, you have finished bump per minute. Dodge is over. Done. Finito. You are in a garden relaxing. I don't know whether you have a garden, or maybe you're in someone else's garden, or maybe you're a cat burglar. That's your business. You receive a mysterious, let's say, Pinterest comment. I know it's a bit of a dead platform. Bump was only the beginning, it says.
I knew it.
You don't even know what dodgems are capable of. Do you A, click the Pinterest link, or B, take a minute to think about it and relax in this garden that maybe you broke into?
I mean, I'm going to B.
You relax in the garden for another few hours until you're caught by a roving gang of citizen arrest enthusiasts. You spend a few hours trapped in their nicely furnished living room while they work out what to do with you, until eventually you sneak out whilst they're debating whether Geronimo the Llama really had tuberculosis. You check your phone and receive an email. Don't ask me for more details, because I've not really worked out what that email says. But anyway, the bit that's important is it says, you want to talk about control and agency in a dodgem-related context? Which is a bit on the nose for the email. Well, in the dodgem world, there's only one big wing: Dodge Corp. We've all secretly been bumping to its tune for years. There's a link to a Google Maps location. Do you A, click the link, or B, attend iconic queer party, Sink the Pink?
Well, I mean, I've got to go to Sink the Pink. I've always...
Even though it is clearly contextually daytime, you attend Sink the Pink. Everyone is extremely happy to see you, especially since it's several hours before opening and there's an awful lot to do. And the hospitality industry needs every help it can get in these difficult times. You spend a good few hours cleaning beer lines, mopping floors, you know, checking playlists, running speaker cables, and until everyone is happy. Eventually, after everything is absolutely ready to get going and everyone's going to have a great time that evening, you leave before the festivities, obviously, because it's about 4 o'clock at this point. And you get on a train to Kent. I guess you should check out this Dodge Corp thing.
That makes sense.
Soon you arrive at Dodge Corp, weirdly quickly, because the British train system is so good and also so affordable. It wouldn't cost you £32 return for a 40-minute train ride to just outside of London, something that I don't do every day. That would be insane. Outside Dodge Corp, which is a large building built to kind of look like a big top because of the circus theme, there's a lone guard. He is large and almost upsettingly muscular. His pecs are so big, they are covering his eyes. He has a piece of paper and is playing tic-tac-toe fiendishly quickly. He's clearly the world's greatest tic-tac-toe player. But is he better than you? What do you do? Do you A, sneak around the guard, or B, challenge the guard to a tic-tac-toe duel for success?
I've got this. Take him on.
Take him on. All right.
I'm hoping tic-tac-toe is noughts and crosses.
It sure is. You leap out in front of him and challenge him directly. He peers at you with his pet concealed eyes. You're on, he says, whipping out a blackboard, or in this case, actually a whiteboard. He goes first, laying out a cross in the top right-hand corner.
Oh no, he knows about the corners.
Your move.
Okay, I'm going to go bottom left.
You put a zero in the bottom left-hand corner. The guard is shocked. He's never seen such an amazing move. He slowly lays an X right next to yours in the middle of the bottom row.
I'm going to go middle.
Middle?
Yeah.
A middle. You lay a zero straight in the middle of the grid. He is horrified. That is the one thing that he didn't expect to happen. He lays an X on the right-hand side of the middle row.
Okay, I'm in trouble here, but I'm going to go bottom right to save myself.
In a fit of genius, Anna leaps in and lays a naught right in the bottom-hand right of the row, thwarting the guard's attempts. His eyes stream with tears. He lays an X in the centre of the top row.
I seize my moment and I go for the top left.
The top left. Anna lays down the final zero, crossing them out smugly, incredibly slowly. The guard is horrified. His face is a mask. You win. He sighs, or maybe he doesn't. His expressions are really difficult to see because his muscles are so large. And opens the door. Guard challenge complete. You move into Dodge Corp HQ. There's a lot of dodgems here, like loads. If you had a problem with dodgems, this is not the place to be. You arrive at the lift, aware that narrative structure dictates you're probably due a climactic rooftop showdown. I don't know, this is a pretty hacky story, don't question the details. You flip into the lift and press the button with the heel of your high heel, which you're mysteriously suddenly wearing. Anyway, you hit the lift button, boom, rooftop, here you go. You arrive at the rooftop. It's like a big dodgem ring thing, whatever it's called, you know, where the cars bump. There's a man there wearing a big top hat pulling some levers. Across the world in unison, you can hear the bumps of thousands, possibly even billions of dodgems. Aha! From here I control all the world's dodgems. Anna Meredith be damned, says the ringmaster to himself expositionally. He turns around. Oh no, Anna Meredith, MBE. You found my incredibly leading Pinterest messages and then subsequent follow-up email with an embedded Google Maps link, he says, weirdly closing a loop that you never really thought was a problem. You will never control my dodgems empire. You can only defeat me if you answer this inconsequential riddle.
Oh, no.
What gets wet whilst drying?
A towel!
A towel! Oh no! The correct answer, he says, recoiling as if shot in the mind with the correct answer, which is kind of exactly what happened. The ringmaster is defeated. He collapses to the ground, evaporating like milk on a hot Tuesday. Among his clothes, you pick up a key. The key to Dodge Corp. Now you are alone. Anna Meredith, alone with the dodgems, and I guess the controls of all the world's sonic bumping. Congratulations, I guess. You won.
Yay! I haven't been so happy for such a long time. Thank you so much.
You're an excellent tic-tac-toe player. You beat the best.
God, that was really exciting. I'm drenched with sweat. Thank you so much. God, that was amazing.
The game is only as good as the player.
Wow.
That's what they say.
Yeah, I really do throw myself into the escape room. I'm the person who's like...
But it's so much about the energy, isn't it? That's what it's about. The thing about it is people always say what makes a great escape room player? I'm like, you've got to care. You've got to want to be inside the room. You've got to want to share information with your friends. You've got to be excited about every moment.
Yeah.
It's not like a show or a theatre show where it's something that's done to you, what you absorb intellectually. You've got to absorb it through your play and your energy because you're fighting against time within that. And the more you can consume per minute, the more fun you're having per minute, the more intense your time is. Mm. So you're playing correctly.
Yes. So... In your excellent game, how did you, you know, how did you control so that there was still a linear narrative while still giving me, obviously, the idea of, well, I still had choices?
Well, you had no freedom. Yeah. Oh,
the curtain falls.
Yeah. Oh my God. There was no freedom. You were always going to defeat the man in the big top, provided you could solve the riddle, which I assumed you could.
I did panic.
So apart from that moment, I had an option for everything, and it always linked back to the central plot. Because, I structured it so I knew where everything was going to end, or had links between it. It was just a machine that, you know, a very primitive on paper machine in a Google Doc. But I knew where everything would go next. And if you went off, I knew how to get back.
So you want to make the user feel like they are shaping it. But obviously at each point, the options of things you could do are limited to make sure it still stays within the parameters of what you've set.
Exactly, precisely.
So could you imagine making a game, you know, does that feel scary, or does that feel like a different kind of creative area, the idea of making something where people had such an extent of control that actually it became something that you weren't defining anymore?
For me, that idea is very interesting. I don't know how you would make an experience where you told a story, and I think that's quite difficult within the frame of music. People do need that guiding hand as well, and where that line is so difficult that it's, I think it's only through failure you ever find out.
It's been great to hear someone talk so amazing and passionately about games, and quite often sometimes I've even felt a bit almost embarrassed about how important fun is to me as a kind of creative starting point. And I've maybe had some criticism from people, like it implies that there's less artistic merit, or that it somehow got less value or weight. And to me, I think this whole process and meeting someone like Nick has really clarified for me just how valuable it is to have things that are fun, and also how serious making good fun experiences is. It's not easy to do. It's like people who say writing a pop song is easy, and oh God, it's not. So it's been really validating to hear these amazing professionals talking about the role of escapism and fun. And music for escape rooms? Yep, I'd do it in a flash.
God, I love an escape room, I have to say. And if Anna's doing the music, I'm there. Thanks very much to Anna Meredith, Nick Ryan, and Nick Moran. The theme music is by Kat Beard, with additional music by Anna herself. This series is produced by Alana Chance and presented by me, Laurent John. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. Next episode, we'll be out on the River Thames to try to reclaim the commons with artist Colsell.